I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. Political polarization is tearing the country apart, with partisans viewing each other in increasingly personal terms as stupid, immoral, even evil. There have always been deep disagreements and conflicts in America, but as we get ready to celebrate the country's 250th anniversary, it feels as if democracy itself, we the people, is on the line. Psychologist Keith Payne says few of us have a coherent and consistent political ideology. Rather, it's our class, our race, education, religion, family, history, line of work, in other words, our life circumstances that shape our social identity and belief system. His book, Good Reasonable People, helps explain why it's so hard to understand and work across the current political divide because everyone believes they are a good and reasonable person. Keith Payne joins us on The Connection today to explain the roots of our polarization, how inequality exacerbates our divisions, and the steps we can take to find common ground. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina. And Keith Payne, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I think if we look back 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, we can see in this country civil wars, we can see civil rights disputes, we can see Nixon and Watergate, times of deep, deep political division in this country. Do you think there's something unique about today's political divide and our political disagreements?
I mean, historically, no. We've had a lot of conflict, as you mentioned, in this country, and it's been very similar along the sort of social identity lines that we're dividing today. The anomaly was really a few decades there from the 1960s through 80s, where the left-right leanings of the people didn't line up so neatly with the Democrat versus Republican parties. And so that was sort of an anomalous time whenever you had Southern Democrats who were sort of segregationist Dixiecrats, and you also had liberal Republicans. And so those left-right ideas didn't line up so neatly with Democrat and Republican, and that has largely gone away now. So we're neatly lined up with social identities around race, religion, education that line up so tightly with Democrat and Republican, and that's the way it was for most of our history and during those very high conflict times, and unfortunately, we've kind of returned to that, and well, that's my maximizing the conflict that we're feeling today. So it's new in our lifetimes, but it's not in the history of the country.
It does feel, though, very intense and even very personal, maybe because we have social media, you know, in our pocket 24/7, and that tends to go to our divisions and the things that make us angry, whether that has kind of exacerbated all the feelings, I think, that people have.
Right, because we're not just divided over policy stuff, right? It's not just about what people think the best marginal tax rate is or what the best zoning laws are. We're divided over social group identities and the moral and emotional reactions that are tied to those. And because it's all about our social identities, the groups that we belong to, the groups that we protect and want to see as good and reasonable people, that creates this intensity, this edge, so that if you say that my group is wrong, you're saying I'm wrong, and maybe I'm even a bad person.
Well, you even begin your book, and I think got your thinking about this idea in your own family. You were having these intense political fights. It sounds like it was early on in the pandemic when so many people were hunkered down and online, I guess, but really with your brother and other members of your family, it was painful because obviously you all love each other, but there were these deep, deep disagreements.
Right. Yeah. I think it was this mix of the frustration of being home and isolated and having to
Right.
interact online, which magnifies everything. But these were actually divisions and arguments that were there from the beginning in my family. I grew up in a small town in Western Kentucky, and I'm part of a very large family, and we've all gone in very different directions over the years. And so what was happening during that time at home in quarantine is I find myself arguing with my brother in one case, various other ex members of my extended family, getting into these really heated arguments online. And I had this experience that most of us have probably had by now, where you're trying to convince somebody that they're wrong and they just can't see it, and you get so frustrated and angry. And I remember this one time I was sitting on my back porch and I was literally thinking about my own family member, you must be either stupid or evil if you can't see the truth that's so plainly in front of you. And whenever I had that thought, that was my cue to say, wait a minute, maybe I need to take a step back, because I'm talking about people who I know and who I love and I know are neither stupid nor evil. But that's the emotional state that those kind of online fights had gotten me into. And so that was sort of a moment when I thought I need to step away from some of the other things I'm doing and write this book.
Well, one of the things you say in this book is that most people do not have consistent or coherent set of political beliefs. And I underscored that because I think if you were to ask someone who believes in gun rights or abortion rights, is this something that you consistently and coherently believe in? They would say, absolutely, yes. I protest for this. I vote around this. These are things that I truly, truly believe in.
Right. So the idea is not that people don't have any beliefs, but they're not as coherent or well organized or as stable as we think they are. So yeah, whenever we're talking about a particular belief right now, I might have a very strong belief. And if you ask me, I'll say, yes, I will believe that next year. I'll believe it 10 years from now. I'll believe it my whole life. But if you look at surveys that have asked people the same opinion questions again and again over time, what you find is that people's behavior, or sorry, people's opinions aren't actually very stable on when it comes to political issues. Even if somebody says, I'm really strong in my opinion on gun rights and I'm never going to change, if you survey them again 6 months or a year or 4 years from now, they are only likely to agree with themselves about 65% of the time, and 50% would be chance, just flipping a coin. So people are much less stable than they think they are. And their attitudes on one issue don't tend to correlate very well with their attitudes on other very logically related issues, right? So if somebody wants taxes to go down, you would think they would also want government services to go down. If somebody wants taxes to go up, you'd think they would want government services to go up. But those sorts of things aren't very well correlated either. And so what the literature suggests is that in the moment, people have a strong sense of their ideology, but it's not as clear-cut, coherent, or stable as we feel it is in the heat of the moment.
Does that mean people are persuadable, or just over time opinions change, or maybe they don't believe as much as they thought they did, when they were 18 years old?
Yeah, I think people are persuadable over time, and they're especially persuadable when we're talking about policies, issues. People are much less persuadable when we're talking about social group identities. So you can, if somebody endorses a piece of misinformation, studies show that you can provide them with a fact check with it from a reputable source, and it's difficult to change their beliefs, but it's not impossible. People on average will shift, will come off of that belief a little bit if you provide them with a high quality fact check. But then if you say, all right, now are you going to change sides? Do you doubt the politician who told you that lie? No, they don't. They're going to stick with their team, and they'll find some other set of reasons or policies that are more consistent. But so being persuadable on a policy is very different than being persuadable in terms of which team you're on.
And by team, are we talking about our tribe? I mean, the people who believe as we do, maybe go to the same church or synagogue or mosque, maybe send their kids to the same school, they live on the same street, that we have these things in common.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we use parties as sort of a shorthand to summarize all of that. So Democrat, Republican, et cetera. And that's an easy way to peg people into us and them. But if you dig into what are the factors that are driving us to align with one tribe or the other in terms of parties, it's those things like religion, like education and social class, like urban versus rural living, race, and ideas about where racial inequality comes from. All of those really personal identities are what's underpinning our Democrat-Republican affiliation.
And yet, as you describe in your family, I mean, I don't know how much of an outlier you are, and I think we all have families where you can see that not everyone is on the same page. We might be part of that tribe, but we might affiliate with a different tribe.
Yeah, it is so interesting to me that families are the venue in which we're having so many of these fights, and there's an increase in estrangement within families. You would think that would be such a strong bond that it could overcome some of these other things about politics, but in a lot of cases, we're willing to give up on our family members rather than give up on our political party, and that's a very disturbing trend that I'm seeing.
You say this really, that when we talk about liberal and conservative, we're really coming at it the wrong way. That we, you know, I guess the stereotype is that liberals are more open-minded because they're more open to new things, whereas conservatives are more dogmatic because they believe in tradition. What's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. It's true as far as it goes. There are these differences in sort of personality traits, differences in cognitive styles that correlate with whether people are liberal or conservative or Democrat or Republican. But you have to keep it in context. In the social science lingo, we would say that's a very small effect size. It's a small correlation. Somebody who's very open to new experiences in things like travel and cuisine is, you know, maybe a couple of percentage points higher, more likely to be a Democrat. But it's only a couple percentage points.
Interesting.
So it's very small effects whenever we're talking about those differences in personality. And you compare that with other factors like which racial group you were born into and which region of the country you were born into. Those have massive effects that are much larger than those individual differences.
We're almost up on a break here, but do you want us to kind of toss out this liberal conservative idea and focus more on these social groups, this social identification that we have?
I think liberal conservative is a useful shorthand, but it's just a rule of thumb. And I think we should not look at it as a deep explanation. We shouldn't. We too often say, why did somebody vote this way? Or why did they go to this protest? And you say, oh, that's because they're a liberal or because they're a conservative. It's not the deep causal factor. It's a summary of all these other deeper factors. And I think we should dig into those if we want to understand the explanations.
Well, let's do that after this very short break. That's Keith Payne. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina, UNC. And he joins us today on The Connection to talk about the polarization that we are experiencing in this country. Wrote a book called Good, Reasonable People. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about the psychology that is driving a lot of our political polarization and what, if anything, can heal this political divide. And again, our guest is social psychologist Keith Payne. I'm looking at the title of your book, Good, Reasonable People. It's a very provocative title, I should say, because I think obviously everyone thinks, well, that's me. I'm a good, reasonable person. What's the thinking behind the psychology of good, reasonable people?
Right. So the claim is not that everyone is a good, reasonable person. Right. The claim is that we all insist on seeing ourselves as good, reasonable people. And, you know, there are deep psychological reasons that we want to be a good person and we want to see ourselves as good and competent people. And so we have a whole suite of psychological processes. Psychologists sometimes call it the psychological immune system that we use to keep ourselves feeling good and thinking that we're a smart and good person. And so sometimes, we're wrong, and sometimes we're not being so good. And when we do that, we nonetheless tend to engage in all of this justification and storytelling to keep bolstering our sense that we're a good and reasonable person. And so that set of stories and justifications gives rise to all sorts of political narratives. And because of that, we usually get the story wrong. We get the story backwards. We think that if I give this person this piece of information, if I explain the facts, then that'll change their behavior when it comes to politics. But what people are usually doing is working in reverse. Instead of doing what they do because of what they believe, they're believing what they believe because of what they want to do.
Do we also think that not only are we good and reasonable, but we are also correct about everything? Is that also what you're saying? So that when someone comes at us or tries to explain to us something that is not part of our thinking, our first response, our first reaction is to reject it.
Right. And we don't necessarily just reject it by saying, by acting like, by stonewalling and saying, I'm just not going to believe it. What we do is we generate counterarguments. Our mind goes into overdrive and we start thinking up facts and reasons why my side is right and your side is wrong. And so at the end of that, we end up with a bunch of freshly retrieved ideas about why I'm right and you're wrong, and we can walk away feeling even more certain than we were at the beginning because we've gone through that active process.
Well, let me take January 6th, the insurrection on January 6th, the attack on the U.S. Capitol. And I think everyone listening to us has seen the video and probably multiple videos of what happened that day. And it is clear that the protesters, the insurrectionists, and perhaps I'm giving my opinion away right there, are beating up on the police. And yet people can look at that video, look at those images, and see something entirely different. Help us understand that disconnect.
Right. So we always want to look to the video evidence to see what really happened. And again, we find that whether we're looking at videos of January 6th or police camera footage of police interaction with citizens, people can look at the very same scene and walk away with very different ideas about what's going on. Because when we perceive a video like that, we're not just processing the literal video in front of us, we're also ascribing meaning to it. If one person is beating another person, well, we also infer, well, did they deserve it? Did they do something wrong? Is this a just punishment? Who's in the right and who's in the wrong here? And in the case of acts of violence like that, we come away not just seeing that this person attacked that person, but we walk away with the whole interpretation. Either this person, wrongfully assaulted that person, or this person, defended themselves. And so the larger meaning of those videos is something that we rationalize right from the beginning.
So if you're part of the mob, the attackers, you believe, because you were told by President Trump that the election was stolen, and that was why you were there, and that justified your actions against the police, per se. It's that
Exactly.
it is that powerful, you're saying.
Absolutely. So, from that perspective, if you think the election has been stolen and the Capitol Police are stopping you from righting that wrong, then the whole thing looks different from that perspective than if you're looking at it as from the perspective of the election was fair and legitimate, and these are people trying to overturn a fair election. The emotional and moral tone changes what we think we actually saw.
I mean, it seems we're then at loggerheads, right? I mean, and you can look at it from completely the other side as also a perspective.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to me that we can sit here and reflect upon it and understand that a person from this perspective would see it this way, and a person from the opposite perspective would see it from the other way. And yet, whenever we actually get into it, whether it's into an argument about it or watching the video, we only see it from our first person perspective. And it feels so obvious to us that it's the only right way to see it. That disconnect between what we know intellectually about how things look from different perspectives versus what it feels like viscerally to be a person looking out from our own eyes in a first person view of the world is just fascinating.
Well, I wonder too, whether if you're part of a group, first of all, I think people will do things as part of a group they would not do by themselves, but that being part of a group gives you that sense of rightness and power, that we're on the right side of this issue because we're all together.
Right. It gives you a sense of consensus. We're all on the same side. It also gives you literally a sense of power because other people have your back. There's centuries even of research showing that when people are in crowds, they do things that they would never do alone. They not only do more of the thing they want to do, but they actually come to want different things, because whenever it's my group against your group, we become much more competitive and zero sum and self-righteous compared to if it's me as an individual trying to work out what's going on with you as an individual.
Is there any way to find common ground under these circumstances? Obviously, in the heat of the moment, it seems impossible. But is there a way to get to the truth or the facts or some kind of common ground?
Yeah, well, it's very hard in the moment, but one of the things we can do is take a step back and toggle to that other perspective I was just talking about. I think even those of us who feel extremely strongly about the first person point of view can also see that we're all people in various groups and positions that are going to have different perspectives. And so taking that step back and seeing myself from a third person perspective as a participant in this larger drama playing out is one way to sort of ratchet down the temperature.
Right.
And because it also helps us see the other person as somebody, in their perspective. And that third person perspective is much more helpful for being able to have a decent conversation about any of it.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's our guest today on The Connection, Keith Payne. He's a social psychologist, a professor at the University of North Carolina, wrote a book just a couple of years ago titled Good Reasonable People, The Psychology Behind America's Dangerous Divide. Can we assume that if people, I don't mean to put this so starkly, but I'll just do it. That if people are Nazis or neo-Nazis, that they think they are good and reasonable people, that they think what they're doing is the right thing.
Yeah, that's right. I think no matter how horrible of a person or a group you point to in history, from their own perspective, nobody thinks they're bad or crazy or evil, right? Nazis loved their children. And just like everyone else. And so it's such a challenging thing to be able to recognize, to have this sort of perspective taking and empathy to recognize that whoever is on the wrong and bad side from my perspective also thinks that they're right and good. To realize that, and also to know where to draw the line, because my point is not just a wishy-washy, let's all get along because everybody's right. No, I believe there are definitely things that are worth fighting for. And it's just so hard to be able to say, I recognize that you on the other side think you're right, and that you're a good, righteous person. And yet, this is where I have to draw the line, and I'm going to stand up for my beliefs here.
I mean, that's where I think things like propaganda and even lying, it complicates the situation, because people who believe lies and propaganda get really pulled into a certain belief system.
Right. Whether it's propaganda, misinformation, people are much less constrained by the facts than we usually assume. There's some fabulous studies on conspiracy theories that show that, you can just make up a, a new conspiracy theory from whole cloth, and if you just follow the script like a little like playing Mad Libs, you can get people on both sides to believe it. So if you say, "Have you heard this conspiracy?" This or they don't.
No, you
have
don't
you
say
heard
that,
this
right?
Story, right?
Yeah.
That Republicans are in league with insert big powerful group here to harm insert vulnerable group here. Democrats will believe it. And if you say, have you heard that Democrats are in league with this powerful group to harm this vulnerable group, Republicans will believe it. And it's almost like we're just following a script. As long as the bad guys are the right bad guys, then most of us are willing to go along and play pretty fast and loose with the facts.
You do say, though, in this book that dehumanizing language is very dangerous, calling people rats. I mean, the Nazis did that, or cockroaches, the other parts of the world, calling people apes. I mean, that is dehumanizing language with the potential for some kind, if not violence, certainly deep cruelty and potential for violence.
Yeah, dehumanization and dehumanizing language is a classic technique that people use as a way to prepare for violence, as a way to lay the groundwork, either for themselves to engage in violence or to get other people to engage in violence. Because if you talk about the other side, not as people who happen to disagree with you, but as rats or cockroaches or vermin, it takes them out of the circle of our moral concern, right? We stop treating them like thinking, feeling, agentic people. And now they're just obstacles to our goals. And so it reduces our inhibitions against violence and makes it much easier for the average person to engage in violent behavior.
It seems that when President Trump posted that picture of the Obamas as apes, why I think the reaction was so strong, clearly racist, but the sort of dangerousness of him doing that.
Yeah, that was one of the few places recently where you could see Republicans standing up and saying you've crossed a line to Donald Trump, because it was such a dangerous escalation to not just criticize people as bad and wrong, but to post those dehumanizing, animalizing images. It's happened again and again throughout history that's something that happens when the warning lights are really flashing red, that violence is around the corner. And we've seen, unfortunately, more and more of that dehumanizing rhetoric.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we're in a classic cycle of escalation right now, right? So the words that justify the violence that then is leads us to justify it again after the fact and say, well, this was deserved and therefore it was right. So yeah, we're seeing a classic sort of tit-for-tat escalation of both rhetoric and violence and the dehumanizing language that justifies it.
You know, I'm thinking also of the killing of Alex Preddy in Minneapolis. And I mean, it barely happened. And members of the Trump administration were calling him a terrorist.
Yeah, there was, before anybody knew almost any information, they were already justifying then saying that basically he deserved it, right? So it's exactly the same thing we were talking about with the January 6th videos. Who you think deserves it changes whether you think it's murder or self-defense, et cetera.
What did you make of the protests in Minneapolis and the pushback?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because I think people have, even to very gross violations of human rights and democratic norms, people have, the reaction against it has been, you know, let's say sporadic. There have been fits and starts trying to resist in various ways. But the very widespread protests in Minneapolis and around that area have been, I think, encouraging as a way of seeing grassroots pushback to increasing, you know, overreach.
We do see polls go up and down. I mean, I don't know how much faith you put in polling or not. I realize it's kind of a snapshot in time, and it depends a lot about how questions are framed and how many people are asked of those questions. But we do see you know, things are not static, that there is some fluidity to people's positions on some of these political issues. What do you make of that?
Right. Well, you know, one of the patterns that we see again and again is called thermostatic voting, right? So people act a little bit like a thermostat in that, you know, if it gets too hot, they want to ratchet it back down. Or if, you know, the country goes too far to the left or too far to the right, people want to go in the other direction. And that's why, you know, typically after a presidential election, the president's administration, the president's party loses votes in the midterms. And that's what we're seeing shaping up right now. And the further the administration goes in furthering its goals more extremely, the further the backlash by the midterms tends to be. So I think smart money is on a pretty big backlash during the midterms this year.
I'm thinking, though, how it's just a photograph can change a person's opinion. There are some very famous or infamous photographs from the Vietnam War that really turned people against the war. I'm thinking of that, you know, that little boy in Minneapolis, Liam Ramos, with his little bunny hat and his backpack. And people saw that. And he was clearly an innocent in this maelstrom of threat and violence.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the opposite of what we were talking about a moment ago with dehumanization. That's humanizing these people as individuals. And I think that's what we've seen both with that little boy and with Alex Preti after he was killed. There have been a lot of tributes and a lot of photographs of him in his daily life, showing him working as a nurse and interacting with people. And, you know, the ability of images to humanize as well as to dehumanize, I think, is really powerful.
Because, that truly is a snapshot in time. It isn't just like a polling snapshot in time, but that image just, it stands still and we look at it.
Yeah, because it's a person, it's not an abstraction. And you know, one general principle that matters in a lot of ways here is that we interact differently with people as individuals than we do with abstractions or statistics or, you know, faceless groups. And so if you can get up, you know, out from behind the sort of windshield of the social media app and talk to a person as a real individual, it's much harder to yell at each other.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with social psychologist Keith Payne. Much more to discuss after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, Keith Payne is our guest. He is a social psychologist, professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina. We have been talking about some of the roots of our polarization. And he wrote a book just a couple of years ago titled Good, Reasonable People, The Psychology Behind America's Dangerous Divide. You touched on this earlier, but I feel the need to sort of pull some of your ideas together about how we can find some kind of common ground and how, you know, maybe facts only go so far. How should we talk to each other to find the things that we do have in common?
Right. Well, there are a number of strategies. One thing is to realize that we do have more hidden ground, more common ground than we think. And that goes back to some of the research we were talking about that shows that people aren't as divided over issues as we tend to think they are. You know, you can't just tell by the fact that somebody is a Republican or a Democrat what they're going to believe about whether it's taxes, same-sex marriage, abortion, any of these things. There's way more variability between people, regardless of what party affiliation they have, than we tend to think. So that's a starting point, because if they're not, you know, as much of a monolith as we think, then then maybe we should actually ask the other person what they believe instead of inferring based on their party label what they believe. And the other part connected to that is that we really overestimate how much the other side dislikes us. So we really are divided, and there really is a lot of animosity between people on different sides of the partisan gap. But when you ask people to estimate how much, you know, each side hates the other, they over exaggerate it by about twice as much.
Because it feels that way. It just feels we're living in this cauldron of hatred.
Yeah, exactly. So the most extreme voices are the ones we hear the most, whether that's on the news or through social media algorithms. Our systems tend to amplify the extremes. And so we hear the loudest voices, and those are usually saying the most toxic things. And most ordinary people going about their daily lives are not out there on the extremes, and they're not walking around hating the other side.
And if we believe we're a good, reasonable person, and so does the person we're disagreeing with, does it make more sense to find out why they believe what they believe rather than trying to change their mind on it?
Yeah, exactly. If you go into an interaction with the goal that I'm going to change your mind, you've kind of already lost. Because guess what? That other person also doesn't want to change their mind any more than you want to change your mind. If you want to have a better conversation, a good place to start is curiosity and asking questions rather than trying to, you know, bombard them into submission with your facts.
And what do you do about the judgments that you have in your head when you're hearing them talk, right?
Yeah.
Keep them to yourself.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can always, I think it takes practice. It takes effort. But whenever somebody says, I believe this because X, and you think that's X is wrong.
Right.
Our normal immediate response is to say, that's wrong, and here's the facts. But if instead you say, you believe this for that reason, well, there are reasons on both sides of this. Why do you feel attracted to that reason? Why do you feel that that reasoning is compelling as opposed to this other one? And, you know, nobody's wrong or bad from their own perspective. So understanding what's going on involves an act of increasing perspective taking.
Have you been able to do this with your family?
To varying degrees.
Something to ask you, Keith. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So like I said, I've got a big family, and some of us are able to come to more sociable agreements than others. But I think definitely compared to where I was yelling at computer screens in 2020, I think I've been able to condition my reactions to be more productive over time. And one way I've done that is I just don't argue with people about politics on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I reserve those conversations for in-person interactions. When I'm having a conversation with people in my family is very different than yelling on the internet. And, you know, I just try to use the internet for looking at family's baby photos and things like that. But
safe subjects. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me ask you about inequality, because that is something else that you spent a fair amount of time investigating, looking to understand, seeing how that affects our politics and our social standing, I guess, or how or where we fit in the social standing. Do you think we're in a gilded age right now?
Yeah, I think income and wealth inequality are at such extreme levels we haven't seen since, you know, right before the Great Depression and the Wall Street crash. It makes me very nervous to see how extreme things are. It's hard to talk about whenever the stock market is high and you know, people with large portfolios are doing great. And it's hard for those folks to understand how people who are not benefiting from things like the stock market, who are experiencing rising inflation on everyday expenses, feel like the economy is terrible. And we're in such different worlds economically, people with, you know, on the higher income and wealth end versus those on the lower income end, that it's hard for us to even imagine what the other group is experiencing.
In fact, you say a really interesting thing, which is that people who are well off believe that they're well off because they worked hard, because of their own talents, and that's why they're doing so well. And conversely, people that are struggling near the bottom feel that the system is rigged against them because they're also working hard, but they can't seem to make any progress in the system that we have. Dig into that for us.
Yeah, so that kind of comes out of just this idea that, you know, we all believe that we're good and reasonable people. And we tell stories about the world in order to make that make sure that's the case. Now, think about what that feels like if you're somebody who's very wealthy. You're a good and reasonable person and you're very wealthy. How did you come to your wealth? Well, probably you worked hard for it and you deserve it. But if you're somebody who's struggling financially, you also are confident that you're a good and reasonable person. What seems like the likeliest explanation for your lack of wealth? Well, it's certainly not that you're not hardworking or not smart. It's that something about the system is holding you back. Now, we have decades of research suggesting that there really are those obstacles that hold people back, and that success is determined by lots of things beyond just hard work and talent. So it's not like that's just a purely subjective question. There are facts of the matter, but when you're either at the top or the bottom of that distribution, which explanation seems more compelling to you is going to change.
Well, it seems that, and this is broadly speaking, so at the top, you look at the people at the bottom and you say, well, they're just lazy, and that's why they're not where I'm at. Whereas people at the bottom look at the ones at the top and say, well, they're robber barons or they're selfish, and that's why they are the way that they are.
That's right. And, you know, it's not even these people versus those people necessarily. We did an experiment in which we asked people lots of information about their finances and their incomes and their expenses and things like that. And then we actually gave them different kinds of feedback. We randomly assigned them to either be told that, you know, that they have more disposable income than people in their peer group. Huh. Or that they have less disposable income than people in their peer group. And what we found is that regardless of their actual level of income or wealth, just that feedback was enough to change the way people thought about the system. So the people who we gave false feedback to say, look, you are above average in wealth. Why do you think that is? They immediately started saying, well, I worked hard. I'm very good at my job. I've made the hard choices and I've taken the risks that justify me having all this success. And people in the other group who, again, were no different, it was just random assignment, but who thought that they were doing below average, they explained their position by saying, well, I work just as hard as everybody else, but there are all these obstacles the system's rigged against me.
Hmm.
So we can shift people's perspective by just a 5-minute feedback intervention. And I think that speaks to how powerful just the feeling of high status versus low status is.
Also, the dangers of comparison, right? Of looking at the other person and seeing something that may or may not be true.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one of the most robust findings in all of psychology is that we evaluate nearly everything, not based on its absolute merits, but how it compares to other people. And when it comes to income, that's certainly the case.
Do you think it's the responsibility of people at the higher end of the income spectrum to have some more humility or modesty, or to look at people that are not as well off as them and try to figure out how to give a leg up or maybe change the system so that it's more equal or allows for more opportunity and equality?
Yeah, I mean, it's expecting a lot of people to expect people who are in the higher income echelons to look at it so objectively, right?
Right.
I think it what would be an ideal solution is to have political processes where the rich don't have so much dramatically more influence in politics, that to have a political system that's responsible to the large majorities of people who are not wealthy, so that the populace as a whole, so that the democracy as a whole can regulate the way that income and wealth are distributed. But right now we're in a situation where the wealthy have so much more influence. It's very difficult for low-income folks to have much influence in the system. But those are substantive policy changes that would make a big difference.
Sure. I mean, the system is awash with cash. Or crypto, or whatever the currency is these days. What you're also saying is that income inequality reinforces partisan divisions, which is what we were talking about when we began this interview, looking at partisan divisions. Help us understand then how, I think I know the answer to this, but how this income divide exacerbates the divisions, politically speaking.
Right. Well, if high income folks look around and see a world in which they're thriving because of their own merit and hard work and excellence, then that's going to predispose them to want to have more, you know, laissez-faire sort of economic policies, right? Let the job creators make as much money as possible. And from their perspective, they're going to see that as a good thing for the whole economy. On the other hand, from the perspective of people who are struggling financially, they're going to see all the barriers. They're going to see social benefits, what the welfare state, redistribution as solutions. And so that's naturally going to attract people to the right and to the left differently.
You mentioned this earlier, but I grabbed something from Gallup, a recent poll, finding that 8 in 10 U.S. adults agree on a variety of issues that reflect core aspects of U.S. democracy, including using violence to achieve political goals is never okay, that elected leaders should compromise to get things done, and that having a mix of races, religions, and cultures benefits the nation and goes on from there. And yet we seem to have a political system that doesn't deal, you know, directly with those issues, that fights about things around the edges, but doesn't work to find consensus.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the average person doesn't have very radicalized views on most of these things. We're much more moderate and in the middle when you ask about those kind of issues. Unfortunately, there are incentives for politicians to speak to the base rather than to the middle, especially with gerrymandered districts. That means that they don't have to appeal to the middle, to the swing voters as much. And so there are all these structural problems like gerrymandering that intersect with our psychological biases, so that it brings out the most extreme, and makes those of us who are more moderate in our reactions have less and less influence.
We're coming up on this year's the 250th anniversary or birthday of the United States of America. What should we be thinking about?
I think we should be thinking about democracy and preserving it above all else, because we get so impassioned with our side being right that, the basic idea of democracy and the guardrails that keep it in place are increasingly something that we're willing to let go in defense of our impassioned positions. And I think, you know, whether this side or that side wins the particular seat or wins Congress in the midterm elections, the most important thing is that there's another election around the corner. And people, you know, need to feel some hope that they can right the wrongs that they've seen going on now and have another chance at the next election if they're going to, eschew violence and support basic participation in a democracy, so that we can have honest disagreements and fight with each other, but we're fighting with words and votes, not bullets.
But hope being the operative word, that if you have hope and belief in a democracy, then you're willing to vote for it. You're willing to fight for it. You're willing to actually believe in it.
Right. And I think, you know, it's this cycle. We need the most important thing we could do is to make the structures and the processes better for actual democracy, make, things like gerrymandering are getting in the way. We need to make sure that people feel that they can cast a ballot and that there's another fair election around the corner if this one doesn't go their way.
Keith Bain, thank you for joining us today on The Connection.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, he's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina. Wrote a book just a couple of years ago, Good Reasonable People, The Psychology Behind America's Dangerous Divide. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow The Connection on Instagram and you can find us on Facebook. Check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows. Debbie Builder produces the show. Al Banks, our engineer. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.